This is part one of the third set of interviews with István Deák, conducted on October 6, 2013. Conducting the interview with me was Máté Rigó, a graduate student in history at Cornell.
So it's October 6th, 2013, and we're speaking with István Deák about his time in the United States. And so we've been talking about the period prior to your arrival in the U.S., and you talked about being in Paris, being in Munich, and we got up to the point just where you had arrived. And this was, can you remind me which year you arrived in?
Well, I came here first in 1955. Mm-hmm. But only for a visit, and I was still, at that time, still attached to Radio Free Europe, and they sent me here to discuss programs. But I officially immigrated in 1956. And in fact, in September 1956, that is a few weeks before the Hungarian Revolution.
You must have been the only person to immigrate a few weeks before the Hungarian Revolution.
I don't know whether he was the only person, but I was certainly felt very interesting, very strange. But by the time the Hungarian Revolution began, I had already been well fixed in America because I was at that time working for a short time only, but still at this time working for Free Europe Press, which was another branch of the Free Europe Committee's organization. We were the book project, about which, by the way, a new book has appeared. I don't know whether you know about it. No, it was an excellent idea and far less violent and far less militant and far less controversial than the radio. And that was that under the aegis of Free Europe Committee, and of course with the money of Free Europe Committee, which is probably, frankly, CIA money, which we didn't know, a little organization was set up of five or six people with one editor, that was Gloria, who I, not at that moment, a little later she was the editor, and that the task of this little group was to select books to offer to East European artists, writers, and scholars, Western books, and then mail it to them. Why it needed this whole committee, it is not even clear to me, but there was a Serbian, or there was a Romanian, there was a Bulgarian, there was a Pole, there was a Czech, and there was a Hungarian.
So, émigré-type books on...
No, well, mostly these were books, philosophy, history. We mostly asked the person what he would be interested in, and then offered him a list for which he could choose one or two books. First, I was convinced that it would not work, that they would not allow the importation of books, or that that authorities would be very suspicious of why different publishers, German publishers, French publishers, it was not only books in English, more in German and in French, or English publishers, why would they offer books free to East Europeans? There was always a little text, we are interested in cultural exchanges and things like this, and your name came to our attention by a friend, and we are offering you two or three books. If I had been the authorities in Eastern Europe, I would have said, this is something very fishy. But they never, ever objected to it. And the result is that I left that, and the whole thing, because I got a fellowship at Columbia, I got married, and I was studying full-time at Columbia. But the first year, or 1.5 years, that was my occupation. Sit there, read good books, and say this book should be offered, this book should not be offered. History, politics. Yeah, some of those books, one or two books were specifically created for the purpose.
Like what?
That mostly, for instance, new roads and new ways in Western philosophy. New historical interpretations of the French Revolution, things like that. And I don't think that I have a single copy left. No. Well, my books are in a total mess. I cannot find them. I cannot find anything. But there was a very nice book which Gloria also will remember, and that was something like New Ways of, New Roads of Western Philosophy. And we put together essays by leading Western philosophers. And that was what we did collectively. But mostly I just read books and decided whether it should be offered or not. And then someone else got in touch with the publishers, and the publishers then got in touch with the person designated, who then said, yes, I would like to have a book on that. It's very interesting when you think that this project was so successful. We are talking here about, I don't remember the figure, and I had no idea about the figure, but this book, which has now been published, and which is by Hungarian, by the name of Frederick Reisch, Reisch Fredi, who wrote about this book project. He was the second most important person doing the book project in New York. I think he talks about 10,000 books.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so we are talking about big enterprise, which one can say, and then there are no reactions or memoirs, or memories, and interviews, which show that a lot of East European intellectuals were very fundamentally influenced by it. And in the good direction, because after Radio Free Europe ended up by inciting to a revolution, which wasn't such a great idea, at least debatable, whereas this incited to a friendly contact and a cultural breakthrough. Of course, it was only possible because of the changes in Eastern Europe, that Poland, for instance, became quite open after 1956, more open than later, so that there was a period when Poland was receptive to Western ideas. And in Hungary there was chaos for a long time, so just as one could write letters absolutely freely, and people wrote letters very freely from Hungary, one could send books. By the Czechoslovaks, for instance, well, there were also changes in Czechoslovakia, and the government thought that it was to their advantage if they did not have to spend foreign currency, hard currency, on important books. People asked for technological books also, so, or anatomy or something like this. So that was certainly to the advantage of the community there. Well, in any case, this is what I was doing.
So, what were your, what was it like watching 1956 from here?
Yeah, well, the obvious answer, that was very exciting. It was very exciting. I was very close, after all, our offices were one floor below the offices of Radio Free Europe. And there were interesting Hungarians there, Imre Kovács and others who were working in the New York office. And of course there was tremendous excitement in that office and as much information as one could have. The major event in my life was that I had imported a Volkswagen from Europe, and I decided on November, early November, maybe the 1st or 2nd November, I don't remember, that I should go back to Hungary to see what my family is doing and whether they would want to leave with me. Who knows what will happen in Hungary. I had no money. I wanted to buy a ticket, so I sold my Volkswagen. And I sold it by driving in the street and stopped in front of a garage, and the man came out. I didn't even plan to say anything, but he saw me stop there and he asked me, do you want to sell that Volkswagen? And I said, yes, actually, I want to sell the Volkswagen. And he said, $700, I remember that. It was quite good, it's a very good condition. But I needed cash, and he pulled it out of his pocket, $700, which was a huge amount of money at that time. He gave it to me. I signed a piece of paper, which is also showed how much, how different American society is or was at that time, that I signed a dirty little piece of paper, and the car was his, and he left with it, and I had $700 in my pocket, and bought a ticket for November 4.
God.
And on November 3rd, I was invited to whom, I don't remember, not even Hungarians, but friends of Imre Kovács. You know whom I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Oh, Imre Kovács was a peasant leader in Hungary, a very good writer, a foremost sociographer, writer on the condition of the peasantry, and one of the founders and leaders of the Peasant Party in Hungary, which was one of the coalition parties in 1945. But he broke away from it by not willing to subject the party to the communists, which most of the peasant leaders like Veres Péter and others were really communist agents, or dupes, put it to be a little bit nicer about it. They really subjected the Peasant Party to the communist. Imre Kovács seceded from that, founded a party, a new party, together with Károly Pályér, the dissident social democrat. And then when that didn't work, and when he was in actual danger, he fled to the West and worked for Radio Free Europe as everybody else who was anybody in the emigration. And he took me to that party where we were celebrating the victory of the revolution. Then we were driving home in a car from the countryside to New York, turned on the radio, and it said, Imre Nagy is sending a message, the Russians are counterattacking. That was 6 o'clock in the morning in Budapest, midnight here, so we heard it when we were driving home in the evening. So I returned back. Could still do that, because at that time tickets were very expensive, but they were also exchangeable and returnable without any fine. So that was my personal connection. Of course, I was very concerned about my family. After all, my Free Europe past was not a great recommendation for them, now that the Soviets are again taking over. And I sent telegrams. I don't think that I ever succeeded in telephoning, but I sent telegrams and letters, to which they answered very openly. Big discussion at home whether they should leave. And finally, my sister mostly prevailed by saying that she would not want to leave. She's a Hungarian, she feels that this is where she belongs. She was slightly socialist, and she said, we have to build socialism here. But she had been demonstrating in 56. She was at every major demonstration, even in front of the parliament where there was this shooting. So she was somewhat involved. My father was also against leaving, because he said, what would he be doing at his age? And which is perfectly understandable. My sister was mostly for leaving because she wanted to see me. So I hadn't seen her since 1948, and there was no chance, really, as it turned out, of my ever seeing her again. She then died in 1961 without having laid eyes on her son for 13 years.
So is your mother wanted to leave?
She was in favor, yes. Okay. Yes, she was in favor, but my father wouldn't. And when I think back to it, I really don't know what on earth we would have done. Because let's say I put the money together for their flight, or they would have been flown free, which we didn't know would be the whole organization and the whole setup dealing with the Hungarian refugees. When I talk to them, it hasn't even started. But let's say I have the money, they come here, then what? By that time, I wanted to be a student, a full-time student. The job was paying very little money anyway. And sooner or later, we would have faced a very big trouble. My father's English was an engineer, but his English wasn't good enough for the purpose, and also he was not up to the standards of today's engineering requirements. My mother didn't have a profession, and my sister was an editor in Hungary.
So you said that your sister was for building socialism. What about your parents? What were their politics vis-a-vis the...
My father was more, despite the fact that they were victims of this communist system, after all, totally innocent victims by having been expelled. My father first, he had his garage and automotive repair shop and everything confiscated in 1948, nationalized. Secondly, their money was gone and confiscated. Then in 1955, they were expelled from Budapest, and they lost their apartment. So he was not one of the greatest victims, but a genuine victim. Nevertheless, he was not opposed to every aspect of this reform movement, Imran Hoca and others. As far as I understood, I didn't talk to him until 1961. I didn't see him until 1961. And he had a principle which I don't know whether I would like to, whether I should repeat, but why not? He said, democracy is not for everybody. Parasztnak nem való a csokoládé. That's a Hungarian saying. Peasants don't deserve chocolate. And he said, the Hungarians are not up to it. So, and today I'm beginning to wonder whether there is not some truth to this saying. At least but mostly he just felt that he was at home. They didn't have their own apartment, but they live in someone else's apartment. I think I mentioned, did I mention how they got an apartment that somebody was leaving, and a friend, they met in the street. By this time they were both back in Budapest, illegally, but they were back. And then I met somebody in the street, said, I'm leaving for the West. Would you like to have the key to my apartment? And that was a very nice apartment in Nagyatádi utca, okay. in near Olaszfa, near Erzsébet királynő útja, yeah. Hüvösvölgy felé, toward Hüvösvölgy. And they lived there for 2 or 3 years. They just moved in, and since they got a certificate from some kind of a Hungarian official that their expulsion had been illegal, that made them worthy of an apartment, so they could legalize their stay in that apartment. That shows, by the way, that Hungary was a country in flux at that time, that it was much easier, as far as I understood from correspondence and what people told me, better in 1956-57, even in 58 for a while, to be against Kádár, to be for the revolution than against it, depending on what you were doing and depending what position you were in. But in the public was so revolutionary at that time that they appreciated you having been expelled from Hungary, that an official would have helped you to get your situation legalized. My father and mother were walking in Budapest totally illegally because they were still under that verdict, expelled, kitiltva Budapestről, forbidden to live in Budapest. They were living in Budapest, and then a policeman asked for their papers. They stopped, the policeman looked at it, but you were forbidden to live in Budapest. How come that you are here? And they said, yes, but this has been lifted. And the policeman said, yes, I see, and gave it back to me. So at that time, policemen, either out of dedication or genuine conviction, or because that was a public sentiment, sided with them at that time, maybe let's say 1957 or 58, I don't know. And then when the edicts were exchanged, officially came the time for a new edict, it said nothing about them being expelled. So that, not that they had a court ruling or some police decision that they were no longer expelled, but the authorities typically ignored what they had been doing before, and they gave them an ID card, which then, since it didn't say that they were expelled, they could stay.
What about your mother? How did she relate to the event?
My mother hated the regime much more enthusiastically than other members of the family. In fact, there were arguments at home, because my sister was much more to the left than my mother. My mother was a lady of the interwar regime. Of course, because of her origin, she could not be a right-winger. She was not at all that. She was quite liberal in her thinking. But that was society that in which she lived, and she was actually quite pleasantly lived. And any change in the appearance of the mob certainly wasn't to her liking.
So did that mean that she that the reform movement also didn't appeal to her? Because
I have no idea. I wasn't there anymore. I have no idea that the reform movement itself, probably yes. I mean, it was made things a little bit better.
Well, I mean, once it came to the revolution, because that was, I mean, if you're looking at it from the perspective of mob, not mob, it's kind of...
I really can't answer. My sister would have been able to give you much more on this. The family was very worried and frightened, and I think, like most people, the great majority of even the inhabitants of Budapest, not to speak of people in the village, had no contact with the revolution except that there was disturbance in the street, therefore one had to stay at home, or there was no bread in the shop, or if one had to stand in line. So it was, I think, for my mother, as for probably 90% of the population, inhabitants of Budapest, it was a difficult time in which one had to worry about the food, one had to worry about the children, in this case about my sister, who went demonstrating, much more some other relatives. This is 56, so that her new husband wasn't yet on the horizon, or was he on the horizon? Anyway, of course he was. He was already, she was married. Of course. What a stupid thing. My sister had been married to her husband for quite a few years. In 1948 she married. And so Polly, the artist, was body and soul for the revolution. And they went together demonstrating. So that my mother's worry was above everything else. She was not really political. So I can't answer it.
So you watched from here as, you know, you were probably more or less alone, and then all of a sudden a bunch of Hungarians showed up after 1956.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't alone because I was involved in this auxiliary operation. And therefore I knew interesting Hungarians there, and also the new arrivals. I met almost all of them. Charles Gatti, for instance, was one of the first visitors, and he brought to the offices of the committee, he brought a huge collection of Hungarian revolutionary newspapers, which they used, Radio Free Europe, and which I think then somebody bought from him so that he had this little money. And I met Paul Jonas very soon, and also some other members of the new Hungarian National Committee that was what. And I don't remember really when I met somebody. Now let's see, in 56 I started there as a student, 59 I became a completely student because I had a fellowship. Even a year before already Gloria was living with me more or less. study, share the little money we had. So I didn't work full time. Beginning 59, I'm a full time student. When is the? I'm 60. No, much later. I mean, I'm trying to figure out when I met Béla Király, the general. And that could not have been before 1963, when I started teaching full-time at Columbia, and when he came to see me and asked me about how to get a PhD at Columbia. And I was about to get my PhD. So that's through him and through others I met actually the whole political emigration. But when exactly, I don't remember.
So. I mean, you fell in between two of the major waves of Hungarian immigration. So the ones that came after World War II were presumably more right-oriented because they were fleeing communism, and then the ones who came in 56, many of whom, as I understand it, were more left-leaning. And what was the dynamic within the Hungarian community after?
Well, first of all, we called ourselves the 48ers, which is slightly self-satisfactory. Those who left in 48 or 47, mostly when we were in Munich at Radio Free Europe, we referred to ourselves quite often, we are the 48ers, that is those who lived in the democratic period after 1945, who believed in constructing a democratic Hungary, and then disappointed or expelled or driven out, left. So we are not 44ers, which is the fascist, and not the 1910 generation of workers, we are the 48ers. We saw the whole National Committee sort of itself as 48ers, even though probably not every member left at that time. But most of them who were in the Hungarian National Committee, which was not running Hungarian Affairs, but seen by the American government as representative of captive Hungary. Mm-hmm. There were people who left, who were at home for the first few years and left in 47, 48 or something. Not really later. So Béla Varga, who was ahead of the committee, who was ahead of the Hungarian parliament, and Ferenc Nagy, who left in 47, who was actually driven out of Hungary in 47, prime minister. Ferenc Nagy in the long list were 48ers. And remember that was quite an affair when the committee, at the urging of I don't know who in America, adopted Miklós Kálai as a member of the committee. Yet Kálai was, in a very twisted way, 48er in this, that he had to flee, he had to hide from the Nazis. I mean, there were quite a few people who left in 44, 45, and they were not Nazis, but almost the opposite. Either they were dragged away by the Nazis and were in concentration camps, or they were Jewish, and they were deportees. That even 44 is a very complex notion. But when one talked about the 44s, then one meant the right-wing emigration, whether one included only the Aerocross, or the Horthy emigration also, mostly the Horthy emigration. Then there were people like Henyei, foreign minister in September 1944, who was a good man, even though he was Horthy, but he was for seceding from the war and he was not a Nazi at all. I belonged to a group, even though I came in 56, it was not the 56ers, no. 56 is very complex again. Those whom the American CIA, the American State Department embraced were the democratic minority, politically committed minority of the emigres, with some questions on who should belong, for instance, to the National Committee. The only concrete thing I can talk about is the National Committee. And for instance, József Kőváró, who was also had been in prison and was a kisgazda, a smallholder, he was taken into the committee. Varga Béla was taken in the committee.
So how long were you on the committee?
I'm sorry?
How long were you involved with the committee?
I had nothing to do with it.
Oh, okay. So
no.
You just knew about it.
I just knew them, yes.
Were there at this point internal political debates within the various generations of emigres in New York? I mean, as early as the late 50s or early 60s?
Oh.
Or was anti-communism sort of...
At that time, anti-communism, yes, but it excluded the Arrow Cross,
yeah,
the
sure.
Nazis. The Nazis were extremely hostile to the National Committee, extremely hostile to the Air Cross, and basically they were very anti-American, even though at the same time they waved the American flag. But they criticized America. Well, they loved the right-wing Republicans as they love today the right-wing Republicans. There is always a very strong political group in America that that European right-wingers associate with. And those who had criticized the Soviet Union very early, the McCarthy types were liked by the right wing. So they were not totally isolated, but as far as the government of America, they were out. They were not recognized. And that, of course, they resented very much because they felt they were the spokesmen, the real spokesmen of Hungary, and to a certain degree they were not lying because many more Hungarians were behind the right-wing leadership of Hungary, Horthy and Szálasi, than there were Hungarians before, behind Béla Varga and Ferenc Nagy and other Democrats. It was.
Could you name some right-wingers who were here in New York, names?
Well, that also varies. I mean, it's very hard to generalize that individual. There's Tibor Eckhart, for instance, I can think of. Eckhart was a smallholder in Hungary, very conservative, but still in the smallholder opposition, who was sent by the Horthy government, I think by Teleki himself, to America to make propaganda for Hungary, for the eventuality that Hungary is acceding from the war, or that at least that Hungary should not be without friends in the West. And Eckhart came apparently with a lot of money. Several million dollars, and what happened to that money is another question. So I mean mostly these very conservative, but not Nazi Hungarians. I can't really think of a far-right Hungarian who would have admitted that he was far-right, who was politically active. We always refer to those masses of Ohio, Arrow Cross, Cleveland, Hungarian Nazis. And they were not really known, not in the public eye, until 1972, the Crown, the Holy Crown crisis. When they came to the fore, found that they had some supporters in American politics, some conservative Republicans. And when they also could demonstrate physically, because they had hired many buses to go to Washington, that they can mobilize masses, whereas again Béla Varga on the other side and Ferenc Nagy could not mobilize masses. There were no masses behind the Democrats.
Could you talk a bit about the Crown and what, because you were directly involved in that, right?
Well, but it's a big jump.
Jumping from 56 to
72, although I mentioned it, but,
yes.
But it's
well,
still a big jump.
I
really would say that of the innumerable Hungarians who came, 30,000-40,000 in 1956, only a very, very small group was politically active once they're here. That small group had been politically active already before. There were powerful people who came from captivity at Recsk. That is, they had been already doing something. The great majority of the Hungarians who came had not been politically active. And they sort of disappeared. In America, they were very young and they didn't wanted to study or they were, had relatives and joined their relatives. So there was not that much political activity. And that smaller group was made up of people who, to categorize them very simply, generally associated themselves with those few years between 1945 and 1947 when there were coalition governments, and there was some hope that Hungary would not be absorbed by the communists or associated. Yes, some of them, Hertai, for instance, who ended up in Southern California, Hertai György, who was an ex-communist journalist, but then joined Imre Nagy, was a leading member of the Imre Nagy group, and who fled in 1945, was first in Brussels, and then came to America. And like everybody, almost everybody else who came, became a professor at the university. Then that was really the profession that the emigration, the intellectual emigration, chose, and to which they were directed.
Did it also speak to a shortage in American academia towards expertise in Eastern Europe, or an interest?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, what was the general university situation? Not only,
What drove that? Was there, an increase of funding to have people hired who were from Eastern Europe, or were there networks already in place that were bringing people in?
Again, I can only answer with a worm's eye view of history. I wasn't involved in any decision making ever anywhere. I know what happened at Colombia, for instance. Colombia had been one of the very, very few places where Russian and East European affairs and East European history had been considered important for a long time. World War I, already Wilson's advisors for Eastern Europe came from Harvard or from Colombia. Colombia had a Russian institute founded, I think, during World War II. Mosley and some other people, Robinson, some other people ran that center or institute when I arrived in America. They had a building in which already graduate students were trained, and these institutes at that time already gave out certificates. You got a PhD, but you also had a certificate in East European Studies, or Russian Studies, by the way. East European Studies is a derivative of Russian, sort of seceded from the Russian Institute. There were lovely brownstones in 117th Street, all gone, unfortunately, replaced by the ugly International Affairs Building. Very nice brownstone. Well, I visited there, I remember, because it was an East Central European Institute of East Central European Studies. Met Robert, my God, Henry Roberts, who was the director, who was a Russian East European specialist already during World War II. He was, in fact, one of the first Americans allegedly parachuted into Romania at the end of the war in 1944. Oh, I'm sorry, 1944. He wrote a book on Romanian history. He was a professor at Columbia of East European Affairs, and he founded, seceding from the Russian Institute, he founded an institute on East Central Europe. And I became a student in 56. I was advised by somebody to go to the East Central European Institute and meet Henry Roberts. And Henry Roberts was very nice. We talked about it. He then said, I remember that, he said, "It's very nice that you are doing this, but that you study history, but what would you like to do with it?" And I said, "I would like to actually study in France at the Sorbonne, and I'm mostly interested in French and Western European history." And he encouraged me to do that, sort of indicating that East Europe has no interest and no future. So that's what I was, a West Europeanist, partly of my own desire, partly because this is the advice that I've received. Then came the Sputnik crisis, 59, if I'm not mistaken, but I might be mistaken, maybe 60. And hysteria swept America. that America is behind, America doesn't understand anything. By this time already the Hungarian Revolution created such a turbulence, self-examination, feeling that they had abandoned the ECB, that they incited them, that they didn't live up to their promises. But the final blow to an American conscious, if there is such a thing, an American public, the part of it that is interested in anything, was the Sputnik. And suddenly there was money. And Colombia was designated as a center for East European research. And that meant that when I went away to Smith College in 1963, a year later I was called back to Colombia to be an instructor here. And I was told by Fritz Stern and Henry Roberts that, and by the chairman of the department, that if I finish within a year, if I finish my dissertation within a year, I will be promoted to assistant professor. If not, I will have to leave. So, with Gloria's help as an editor, I finished the dissertation while teaching four courses. Four courses. We taught at that time three sections of contemporary civilization, which is unbelievably difficult, especially for immigrants who doesn't even understand 17th century English language, and won my own course. So four courses, and I finished it. And I was promoted and invited immediately to join the East Central European Institute. And Roberts then said, you are, even before he already said, if you need any money for research, we have some money, and they gave me money. In fact, I wanted to go to Europe to do research on my master's essay, and I went to him and said, could you perhaps pay for my flight? That I was still a graduate student, and he said, oh, of course, how much do you need? I said, $400 or something. He said, that's too little. He gave me $1,000. So, because already they had money, and the money came from Title VI was, I think, this fundamental governmental rule or whatever that is, law, according to which centers have to be set up for the study of Russia and Eastern Europe. And quite exactly whether other regions are involved, I don't know, but they were set up, and Colombia became an absolute center for Hungarian studies, partly because there were already Hungarians here, like János Lotz, the linguist, and partly because Halasi Kun was here, who was a Turkologist, but he also was not Hungarian. For one reason or another, I don't know, Colombia's library got huge amount of money for Hungarian books. And Hungarian, they really have a very nice collection of Hungarian books. So, and I was really part of it. I was profited from it, obviously. And then became an assistant professor in 1963, then I wrote my dissertation on German history, and defended it in 1964, and in 1967 I was given tenure, which is not much fuss. Today it's extremely difficult. At that time it was generally more easy. Certainly they favored Colombia, people who were already there, as on tenure track positions. But I'm sure that the fact that there was money played a role. Fortunately, my job was not Sputnik money, as we refer to it at that time. That is not soft money. It's not that the government poured money. I got a regular position, which was endowed, which was paid by the university. But other people were hired into teaching positions. And I remember there was a professor of Albanian, and he was there teaching. And then after a few years of teaching, the question of tenure came up. And the Columbia then said, I was then involved already in these things because I was sort of the leader of the ECB Institute, because Roberts was getting away, moving away to another university, I can't think of the name now. And the university said, we don't have money for it. And the professor of Albanian obviously was terribly upset, and there was a big scandal because he deserved it and booked, why not? And finally the university took over his position, which was a soft money position, that is, was temporarily financed by the Ford Foundation. Ford Foundation was a conduit for government money, but not forever. And so that at that time it was often mentioned that because of the Sputnik, several people were taken into Colombia who on soft money, whom the university had to take over, and therefore they created a real burden for the university. And this Albanian professor, for instance, who was not that young, he was a refugee himself, and whether he, in what faction to Albanian politics he belonged, they better don't ask. he then retired. He was practically forced to retire. So yes, he was given tenure, but made to understand that he would never be get a salary increase and that he should get out there. And he was a very bitter man, and he left and retired as an associate professor. He was not promoted to full professorship because he had been taken in, not his false premises, he didn't ever lie about anything, because he was taken on money that had not been provided, not set aside by Colombia for a lifetime appointment. So that was, but then it became very fashionable everywhere else. And all these refugees, by the time we finished and they finished their studies, they went somewhere. And suddenly there were East European centers and Russian institutes or combined institutes or separate institutes and centers everywhere. Probably before 56 or before 45, there was no such thing, or one or two places where such things were taught. But then came the Ukraine Institute, and then came the Peter Sugar in Washington, and Yuri Baran in Detroit, and Denver, and so on and so forth. And MacCag in University of Michigan set up centers, because that was the time of setting up centers, and they were excellent people. They graduated, they got a PhD. Part of their life was not only to teach East European history, or specifically Hungarian history, but to set up an East European Studies Center. And once you set these things up, and there is money, you perpetrate the professional, perpetrate this line of studies. And this worked quite well until the 1970s. In the 1970s, suddenly there was an inflation of PhD graduates in general, especially in history, and there was a crisis, and afterwards the situation sort of calmed down. But the excitement, what I really call the Sputnik excitement, lasted from the late 50s to the early 1970s. And which allowed for the creation of these East European centers. And therefore, every university became, once you have a center and you have a talented young professor, then the university itself becomes interested in it. If there is nobody, the university is not interested in. A university in Colombia is not interested in East European studies, Russian studies, because there is no one here. If there were somebody here, they would be interested. It's a very mutual influence. And that there were at Columbia, when I became a student, there were four or five really excellent people in Russian, Paul Zinner, for instance, in Russian East European Studies, and they created the necessary stimulus with conferences and books and exhibits and visiting professors, and East Europe was still very interesting, considered very interesting for quite a few years. And once this, for instance, now referring to all this, once these people left, frankly, when I left and nobody was replacing me, the whole thing began to decline. Not because I was so outstanding, but I had that position. And once I had the position, I had students. When I had students, the students went to other places once they finished, and they created centers, and they had still some contact with the university where they had come from. That's how it works.
So we were talking to Ivan just now, and he talked about the kind of heyday for Eastern Europe as being, I mean, from his perspective in the late 1980s. And here you're talking about the post-Sputnik period of the 60s up until the 70s. If you had to say, you know, what was the, if there was a golden age, when not only was there, were there resources, were there people, but the good, the best kind of work was being done, you know, in the time that you've been witnessing it. Where, when was, if such could be called, the golden age?
Well, I would say yes, in the late 50s, 60s, beginning of 70s. And then later again, although I really wouldn't be able to put my finger on it, it came back again. The universities were again awash in money in the 1980s and 1990s, by exactly, I don't know, so that most of these centers flourished.
It's probably about Poland, right, and solidarity.
Well, yes. Of course, you have to provide the stimulus.
Right.
And we,
well, but that's—I mean—that's the question. Then, is it does—is it? I mean, to have a good intellectual atmosphere, is it really just about money? I mean, is that the kind of sine qua non?
Well, no, it's not, because the money and the excitement are connected. The money and the stimulus that comes from Eastern Europe. If there is an exciting revolution like the Prague Spring, 1956 in Hungary, Prague Spring, Polish events, all the way from 1956 to Solidarity, and then the suppression of Solidarity, then the world takes cognizance, especially a world that at that time is concentrating on Europe. A world for which what happens in Hungary or Czechoslovakia is important. And now all these wonderful young people and running around and waving flags and doing good things and making wonderful declarations. Now, there is a revolution in Eastern Europe, apparently, so I would say a counter-revolution. But it doesn't, except for a certain right-wing groups in America, it is not going to excite the Western or American public, because it's not colorful. If nothing else, it's not colorful. It's retrograde. It's where you get, you have to have young people. You cannot get young people excited, not today at least, a certain periods you can, with being against abortion and against same-sex marriage and everything that they believe in. So it's small wonder that there is a little interest, but I don't think that is a major reason. The major reason is that America is no longer Europe-oriented, and that China and India are much more important. I mean, the children in high schools, even in elementary schools, sometimes study Chinese, and nobody studies German or French.
What is the role then of the historian who is teaching one region where, you know, things, the attention of the international eye has come to it and flicked away from it, and it's there for a while, but, you know, centers around colorfulness and or conflict in the case of the wars of Yugoslav secession. So how should the historian view and or weather these capricious attentions?
Well, the historian can sort of change if he wants to, if he feels like it, change into global history or try to fit it into global history, comparative history, write some certain specific aspects of history, of his region's history that would appeal to others like gypsies or sex or women, or that is sort of has a wider meaning. But on the other hand, I don't think that it's, since there are far fewer historians now speaking who deal with Eastern Europe, there is demand for some of them. It's not that there is absolutely no interest and no demand. I don't think that it's necessarily more difficult for the reduced number of graduate students today who are in Eastern and Russian studies, more difficult to find a job than, for instance, 1950s, 70s, when it was extremely difficult, or 1950s, when I was told that I had no chance because I was too old. That's what the chairman said to me before Sputnik. he said, well, what do you want to do? You are over 30, you will not find a job. And then came the Sputnik and I got a job. Like the Sputnik came, everything that went with it, that the world understood that Russia is not only won the war for them, which they didn't want to admit, but secretly felt. I guess many Americans felt it. But that Russia is capable of tremendous achievement.
Does it make you look differently on events as being, I mean, let's say, I think oftentimes the historian tends to think that all history is important, you know, that because that's what we do, and that the public eye being on a particular moment doesn't necessarily make that moment all that important. But are those moments genuinely? I mean, is Sputnik, is that really an important moment in history, in the sense that it's not just that everything is focused on it, but that something actually happened where the world changed.
Yeah. Well, if you ask specifically about Sputnik, not that I have thought
through.
Or, you
know, you can pick something.
Yeah, but if you think that specifically, it is, from the point of view of Russian-American relations or politics, is much less important than it was thought at that time. Because it was thought the Russians are ahead of us and that's a terrible problem, the terrible crime. It turned out to be unimportant because Russia collapsed anyway, even though it sent the first men in the space and so on and so forth. And it had nuclear bombs, it still collapsed. From a point of view of human progress, it was a tremendous step forward.
Is that why it was important?
Yes. This is not, but for the masses to understand it, to appreciate it, one had to, or somehow, they would not have appreciated it had it not been connected with politics. Because politics is more understandable, more personal, then that is this little thing that I saw, remember having seen that circulates here is starting a new age. It started a new age. By the way, did you know that, where did I read it, that the Voyager, and that the Voyager has a computer which is now today laughable.
Oh, yes. Yes.
That any iPad has a much, much more
but
advanced.
But it still works, right? I mean, that's the kind of wonder it's been how many
years.
Yeah,
it still works.
Well, then it's okay.
And a 25-watt bulb or something.
Oh, God.
It's very strange. Yeah, it's very strange. So, that would be my answer.
Okay.
As far as every region is interesting, I mean that I don't see why we shouldn't deal with the cradle of Western civilization, which is Europe as a whole. Maybe not, doesn't have to be separate from West from East. I write my book on Europe. And even though there's a little bit more on Eastern Europe than some other people would include in Europe, when they talk about collaboration, resistance, and my approach is different from what normally the approach that would be taken. I think that this, if you advise students, that's what I would say. I no longer advise students. Try to look at it in, not in a global sense, but in the sense of what did Europe mean to the world and what it brought and how it changed the world. And then specifically what Eastern Europe did. By the way, Henry Roberts always said, and he was my first master, he said, why are we always writing about, talking about Bela Kun? Why don't we talk about Bela Bartok? Which I think is quite nice.
Yeah. Could you talk a bit about Yeah, I'd like to get to the Crown of St. Stephen. I think we're going to have to. And because you were involved in taking it back to Hungary, and that was in 1972, you said?
Yeah.
Or was it
72, 73, I always mix that up. December 72.
Okay.
Yeah.
And could you talk about, you mentioned a scandal and how it affected the Hungarian community here.
Yeah.
Could you talk just about that whole event and your involvement
yeah.
in it?
My personal involvement is that I got a telephone call, that is my daughter, who was then five or something, no, seven. She picked up the telephone and she said, "Papa, the White House is on the line." So that was that was an exciting moment, and it was Zbigniew Brzezinski himself, who was then President Carter, National Security Advisor, and he said, "István," we were colleagues, we had been colleagues at Columbia, he had been a member of the institute of which I was the director, not that he respected me very much, but we had been met often on fairly good terms, and he was on the line, he said, "Well, I have to tell you that we are planning to return the Crown of St. Stephen, and I would like to write a report on the meaning of the historical meaning of the crown." It was very nice of him, and then I wrote a several-page report, which I sent him, which became one of the many documents that was then used for all the debate and planning that went on. And I was, of course, in favor of returning the crown. Not, of course, because most people were against, but I was for it. It belongs to Hungary, and not true that it would be melted into ingots, and not true that the Russians would steal it. What I didn't know, that it would be used for political purposes by the right-wingers. That I didn't know. I wouldn't return it today. Because they, first of all, among many other things, the right-wingers today are violating the original agreement, which was that it should be exhibited in a place where it can be visited by anyone at any time. And that means the National Museum. Can be whenever opening hours it is available. Whereas the parliament can be closed and was often closed for political reasons or demonstrations or whatever, or when they feel like it, they close it. And not everybody feels like going to the parliament and not everybody is like there, so that it's a clear violation, in my opinion, of the original agreement, which I wrote to Prime Minister Orban at that time when it was transferred in 2000, and of course I never got an answer. So that was already my fundamental objection to what happens to the crown today. At that time, the Carter government was pursuing a policy of active engagement with Eastern Europe and persuading the East European governments to pursue a more open policy toward the West. And whether it was also meant in the ultimately to destroy the system, I have no idea. Maybe that's what Brzezinski had in mind. But part of it was that certain countries should be rewarded for changes in their policy, for opening prisons, for allowing their citizens to travel or to read whatever they want. And Poland and Hungary were choice cases for that. So it started out with that we have to reward these two countries. And Poland was rewarded with Carter's visit. I don't know what else they got on it. But Hungary had a very specific affair, the crown. Not that the Hungarians were very keen on asking for it, but it was there, and I mentioned it, and the Americans were very much aware that they are sitting on the Holy Crown of St. Stephen. So that I don't remember who, probably Brzezinski brought it up to Carter and said, "There is this crown and maybe it should be returned." And then they started asking around, and I think they came to the conclusion that this would be a good bargaining chip in the discussions with the Hungarians, and that worked out well, yes. And there was a long preparation of which I know very little until that moment when he called me and he said, "Would you write?" By this time I think they already had practically taken their decisions. And even with the Hungarians, there were negotiations. But they needed documentation, mostly for the hearings, that were to follow. There was a subcommittee for congressional subcommittee for the question of returning the crown, and this subcommittee in the invited testimonies and witnesses. And so I was one of those who was asked to write a testimonial, which was used. It's in the congressional records what I wrote, but the more important things were the politicians, like Béla Varga, Béla Király, who were invited, and who I think without exception, these democratic politicians recommended that the crown be returned. But meanwhile, there was quite a scandal, and there was a congresswoman, Oki, in Ohio, who took this up, and many others, whom I don't remember again their names, and she took this up as an issue, partly in order to win over the Hungarians in Ohio, and or the East Europeans in Ohio, and partly in order to, because she believed in it. I mean, one never knows where faith changes into utilitarian interest. The two are combined, you cannot separate them. And so there was quite a campaign, and it made it into conservative newspapers, and then when there were these hearings, then Hungarians arrived with Hungarian flags flying in hired buses, went into the hearing rooms and shouted and demonstrated, at least waved their flags. I wasn't there, so I cannot say I wasn't invited. I was only invited to write this paper. But of course, because these things had been decided well in advance and discussed by the Hungarians, there are books on the subject. Some of the books I have or had, I no longer find any of them. Some books I haven't even seen, but there are several books on the subject now. And the essence of it was that the Hungarians were forced to make some concessions, especially business interests and debts that Hungarians owned to certain businesses, and also that they should allow freer travel. The Hungarians, of course, said, we have to get visas, Americans had to get visas. No, that wasn't an issue yet. Visa was not an issue. But free exchange of ideas and free exchange of goods was very much a subject. And at that point, then they called me and they said, you have been selected. Would you accept to be a part of the delegation? And so I became part of the delegation. That was December 72, and we were first invited to Washington, where we met all sorts of experts on the Holy Crown, both Hungarians from Hungary and Americans, and political leaders who talked to us. There were Hamilton, Representative Hamilton, who was a very foremost Democratic representative, and he was really the leader of the delegation, although the official leader was the foreign minister, the Secretary of State, Vance. And then there were others. There was a bishop, and then there was Rabbi Schneider, who is always in every conceivable delegation. Schneier. And Representative Weiss, who was my representative, who is Hungarian origin, and then some others. And we were put together this 20. We were invited in Washington. From Washington, we were taken to Andrews Airfield, and then in United States airplane in the US-1, we were flown first to Scotland for refueling and for a little celebration there, and then from there to Budapest. It was a very mixed group. How exactly it was put together, the head of the Penn Insurance was there, the head of the editor-in-chief. Well, that's the biggest Hungarian insurance company, Hungarian-American. Then there was the editor of Népszava, Gombos Zoltán. Then there was, as I said, a bishop. There was one black lady who had really no idea why she was there. But she was the editor-in-chief of Newport News. Mm-hmm. No, I'm making an idiot of myself. She was the deputy mayor of the town called Newport News in South Carolina. The Hungarians always referred to her as editor-in-chief. You couldn't imagine that Newport News is a town. So there were funny things. Of course, I made a stupid mistake. Knew she was the deputy mayor. Then there was a very nice Hungarian lady. I said, how did you get here? She said, my daughter works for the National Security Council, and when the list was put together, she said, nobody represents the female gender. And she called her mother and said, would you like to come? And she said, would you like to go? And she was Hungarian, the mother. And she said, oh, I'd love to. I met her a few years ago in Washington at a commemorative meeting of this thing. And she saw that they called her Washington, would you like to force a flight to Budapest, Mr. Oikron? And that's how she got there. She was the Lippmann housewife. And then, of course, Albert Szentgyörgyi as the most respectable Hungarian, and a few others. Then some interpreters who were Hungarian, Erdős, who became the later became ambassador to the UN in New York. There was also a very interesting young man, Csaba, what kind Csaba? Terrible, my memory is really going. Csaba, whose father had been arrested by the communists, who himself was an emigre here, and who was an organizer of Hungarian emigration. He was chosen as an interpreter, so there were some other Hungarians. But the group was maybe three or four Hungarians, and most of them not Hungarians. Yeah, there was a senator, there was another representative, there were four or five people who represented the American government and Security Council. And then the two ambassadors, the ambassador to Hungary, and the Hungarian ambassador who flew back with the group. Then they arrived, and it was quite a spectacular. We got out of the plane, and there was a huge band, military band playing Rákóczi March, and we assembled there. They were receiving line, Cardinal Archbishop of Esztergom, the Bishop of several Protestant bishops, and the Hungarian chief rabbi, and all sorts of Hungarian politicians were in the receiving line. The only problem was that they couldn't get Gizella's cloak out of the airplane, because it was put together, that contraption which held the cloak was put together in the airplane. They didn't know how to take it apart, and they didn't fare out, get out of the door. So we had to wait, and it was unbelievably windy and cold. This is late December, and we had to stand there in our very thin outfits, and so did Szentgyörgyi, who was an old man, and so did the others, and we stood there and stood there and stood there. And I think then they didn't manage to take it out, and some specialists had to come and take it apart. We were then put into cars, and a long line of cars, absolutely no one outside was told. So there was a receiving line, but the public was not told, so there could be no demonstration. And we were taken to the Hotel Intercontinental, which was at that time the most elegant hotel in Budapest. We were given a nice room. We were given dinner at 2 o'clock in the morning. Unbelievable buffet. Unbelievable. What caviar and everything was served there. And then during the day there were receptions. We were visiting the parliament, the president of the republic, or president of the presidential council, Loshansky, received it. We saw everybody was official, but we saw absolutely no one in his capacity as Communist Party leader. That was the agreement, that this is a state-to-state and people-to-state visit or affair, that the Communist Party is just one party and we have nothing to do with parties. There is no, there were Democrats with us, but that's just because they happened to be Hungarian, not that. There were also Republican representatives. So Kádár was not to be seen at all, and no Kis. Apró Antal was there because he was the head of the parliament. So this way we met some Communist Party representatives. And then there was ceremony after ceremony. There was a huge dinner, there was a reception. The most dramatic ceremony was in the central hall of the parliament, where we saw the crown for the second time. We first saw it in Washington, and then I second saw it when it was opened and put out in the same glass case, I think, that it's probably now today. By this time, the cloak was also exhibited and all the other regalia, and it was very, very nice, very touching. And there was a nice speeches, and everybody was very conciliatory and very polite. And then there was a huge reception in which 10 actors and 5 artists and 15 peasants and 12, I'm just inventing these figures, but every profession, every group was represented. There were peasants in wearing boots and fishermen wearing fishing, no, not quite, but almost. I mean, the Hungarians really came with people's representatives, and we were the American people's representatives. And as we were talking, and of course I had some people I knew well, and that was it. And for me personally, was a very special event because I was able to go back to Hungary after having been expelled in 1973. This is, what am I saying?
Not 73, earlier.
Wait a minute. I was expelled in 19... The date is totally wrong. You really shouldn't talk to me. 1979 is the crown.
Okay.
Not 1972. I was expelled in 1973. We brought back the crown in 1979, if not 1978.
So are there moments, and then we can take a break after this one, but are there moments when you have been aware of what's going on in Hungary or been part of what's happening in Hungary or around Hungary, where you've thought this country or this place or this culture is really something special? I mean, moments where you felt especially connected to Hungary.
Well, I always felt connected, yes, of course. I mean, my bad profession. I mean, to a certain degree, I'm a professional Hungarian. And that's what I try to get away from. At Columbia, I said, I'm not a professor. I don't want to be a professional Hungarian. I don't want to live on my knowledge of Hungarian or knowledge of Eastern Europe. I'm an East-West Europeanist. But Henry Roberts, who wanted to leave Columbia, wanted to have a successor. And he offered me the position of being director, and also that I can do something, I can organize it, we can buy books, we can have conferences, and we can have an institute. So, and I should teach East European history. There was a great pressure on me because there was a need for that and an interest for that, and that I would be the right person. From there, but I'm not a nationalist, I'm not a madman, that's exactly what I want. So the result is that I became, against my really best conviction, I became a professional, maybe not professional Hungarian, professional East Europeanist. Not the necessary preparation, because I don't have enough languages. I mean, today I wouldn't be considered for a minute without more languages than I actually have. And I never even prepared with, never thought of it that I would be that. I wrote my dissertation in German history. I studied in Paris. I took my exams in French history. I considered myself a Western historian, but there were Western historians there. Columbia had several, Paxton and Woloch and Stern and Warren and five or six others. There's a huge department. They didn't need me for Western European history. Fritz Stern thought of me as one Dave Warren's successor. But that was not yet actual. But actual was that Henry Roberts left and that he wanted me to take over the East European Center. So that's why I got into Eastern Europe, and then really I would say malgré lui, I became an East Europeanist, and I think I, to a certain degree, I paid the price for it. because if a West Europeanist, I would have written books more, not more important, but more certainly more popular. I would have had the chance. I was used to French archives, for instance. I worked in French archives. I was actually employed in the French archive for a while. So, but that's what happened. I don't regret it, but occasionally I say, yes, it would have been different had I stuck to my guns that I was hired as a West Europeanist. I probably would not have had tenure. They would have been forced to send me away because there was no need for another tenured East West European. I don't know, really. That is all speculation. No, professionally then I was very much in East Europe. And then all these other things happened. Then Soros appeared on the horizon and with the request that we bring over dissidents, help them, accommodate them, allow them to take courses or to listen to lectures or give lectures. First contacts with official Eastern Europe began, the Ford Foundation visitors came. It all meant a lot of work, a lot of involvement. Yes, I was very deeply involved.
Well, involved, yes. And that's why I was wondering, because you are kind of an exception to the extent that, I mean, you came at a different time, you came with a different interest, you were trained differently, and I mean, that's part of the reason why you were picked, like, for the reasons you said, you're not a nationalist, you're not a map. but were there ever moments, have there been moments where you have thought it's not just your professional identity, but that it's also something where you say, this culture, or this place, is something special in yourself, or whether there's a particular historical moment or personality, or I mean, you've written on Kossuth, and you know, you have talked about the officer corps. I mean, is there something that ties you to this place that you could talk about, not just in terms of your profession, but on a human level? I mean, I'm sure there are lots of such things, but in a kind of passionate way.
Well, of course I feel passionate about it. I felt very passionate about it in 56. I feel passionate, although passionate, in my disappointment today. That I felt very passionate in 1945, because really I belonged to a group of young people who were, I don't know what we were doing, we were not doing anything special, we didn't belong to any political party, but we often get together and talked about how wonderful life will be in this new democratic country and how we have to fight against reaction. At that time we were rather left-wing, and it was the danger of the fascist coming back. And it, when I think of it, it wasn't a non-danger. Since the communists had all the power and the Soviet had the bayonets, there was no such danger that the right wing come back. But we couldn't know that the Soviets could leave. And it really, you saw the same types who are now in power today, their parents. And they had a terrible lot. And they were a terrible lot. And they proved themselves a terrible lot in 1944, if not before, for the last 20 years. And there was a very strong drive for returning to that way of life. And the Hungarian, large part of the Hungarian public was in favor of it, because they themselves were like this. And if nothing else, they were anti-Semites. If nothing else, they had stolen enough goods from the Jews and from others to feel that they don't like the new regime, because it might take it away from them, as it actually did, and put it in other pockets. I'm very cynical about this, but that's what happened. Of course I felt very excited, but then came the first disappointment, and ever since I have a lot of disappointments. I'm very disappointed in 56. I don't think that it would have had a good outcome, now that I see what these people are like. And so after 56, the Pongratzes and others, they were fascists, many of them. And to deny this is to deny history. And I would have, God only knows what the outcome would have been, depending on who has influence in Hungary after 56.
Wasn't 1989 different in this perspective for you?
1989 was by this time I was much more jaded. I didn't believe in it very much. I think it was a peaceful transition. Yeah, I had illusions. I thought that it would be better. And after all, the few years, the 20 years that followed afterwards was, in many respects, Hungary became a much better country than under the communists, and much better than under Horthy, and much certainly better than under Szálasi. But more and more I come to the conclusion that this is not for them. That's not what they want. That's not what the population, the majority of them, wanted ever. And that they now they have the liberty of changing back to something that they like, they are doing it. And that's not only there, because it's happening in Cyprus, apparently in Poland, and it seems to be happening in, to a certain degree also. Why Hungary is in the forefront of that, that I don't understand. Because Hungary in many ways was the best country in Eastern Europe under communism. So it's very hard to say. I mean, one has all sorts of impressions and illusions. Certainly, in 1989, I had the impression that this is going to be better. But I also discovered very soon, which is nobody's fault, that is no longer my world, no longer my generation, because the people I knew were getting older, getting out of it, or moving to California, or dying. So I don't know them, even the Democratic people. Dembski, let's see, whom I met, doesn't mean the same thing to me than Kőváró, who was also mayor of Budapest, and because Kőváró was more my generation. This is not a question of age, really. Horthy means more to me than Kada, because Kada is the same generation. That's my generation is gone. Most of it is gone. So I was much more involved, much more enthusiastic about, or much more disappointed at that time than I am now. And I settled on to the understanding that this is not a world that I mind, that I will ever go back to, and not going back. And I live my own life here, and that's, I'm happy to be an American. I mean, one should not forget it. We tend occasionally to forget it. But I'm very much aware of the fact now that I'm an American, and I'm immensely happy with it. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I'm quite satisfied with it, although at the moment Americans also are quite problematic. Yeah, but they feel much closer to that then. But that's mostly a question of, I still live here, so that issues I'm involved in, Hungary is very interesting and troubling, but it's not where I live. So that's for instance, I consider it absolutely wrong of people of my age or somewhat younger taking up the Hungarian citizenship and having the arrogance to want to vote without paying a penny and without having anything to do with the country. So that's another thing what I'm extremely upset about, the Hungarian policy of giving passports to anybody who comes around and allow them to abuse this citizenship to the detriment of those who live there and to suffer the consequences of their existence.